Welcome, 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 beloved listeners to LNL. You may recall that when we had a photo finish election in the United States a while ago with two putative presidents in Bush and Gore, it took the Supreme Court to hand the crown to the Republican. Well, we've got a pretty tight election in Indonesia, and in just a minute we shall be discussing matters arising. And I want to then complicate the issues of surrounding Sri Lanka, Australia and the boats by actually talking to some prominent Sri Lankans. We'll be meeting with a former ambassador to the United Nations and a former vice president of the UN Human Rights Council from Colombo, and also to a Sri Lankan MP and former secretary to the Ministry of Disaster Management and Human Rights, and, yes, with a spokesperson for the Tamils. Now, the quick count, as you've heard in the news, shows that Widodo will become the second directly elected president in Indonesia's history, but his opponent, Subianto, has also claimed victory or is not conceding defeat. So what's in store for the incoming president of the world's third largest democracy, most populous Muslim country, and the largest economy in Southeast Asia? And add to the problems that the next president will face, any president will face, the appalling state of infrastructure, education, health, widespread corruption, and so on. So it's an uphill battle. And, of course, if you're listening to the repeat, more will have occurred on this fast-moving story. Joining me in the South Bank studio is Tim Lindsay. Tim is director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society in the University of Melbourne, and Tim's tomes include Constitutional Law in Indonesia. Yuli Ismatono is the deputy chief editor of the English edition of Tempo magazine and joins me online from Jakarta. And Elizabeth Pisani is an epidemiologist, a journalist, and director of Teniata Limited. It's a public health consultancy, and Elizabeth is the author of Indonesia Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation. Tim, both candidates, or we seem to have two candidates who are not conceding defeat. What happens next?
Well, in fact, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, has claimed victory. He did so fairly early on. Prabowo's given a somewhat lukewarm response in which he doesn't quite claim victory, mentions victory, and certainly doesn't concede. But I think it's pretty clear that Jokowi has won. The quick counts are fairly reliable. In the past, they've been accurate to about 1%. And they're all, except for the really dodgy ones that lack credibility, all the credible quick counts are showing a victory of around about 5 points or so. So it does seem pretty clear that Jokowi will be the next president, whatever Prabowo's camp does, and I expect they will probably do quite a lot to try and overturn that. But there will not actually be a formal official result until 9 August when the Electoral Commission announces it. And we can expect there to be a large number of disputed return cases. There are already allegations of fraud. Whether or not fraud's taken place, those allegations are pretty inevitable. Prabowo's campaign has been an aggressive, well-funded, well-organised one, and notable for unparalleled levels of black campaigning and smearing in a way that's never happened before in Indonesian elections. So whether or not fraud's taken place, it will be alleged, and that will go to the Constitutional Court to decide.
Now, Yuli, I must say that members of the media rather enjoy political chaos. It's such an interesting time to be in the trade. You're going to be a very busy person.
Yes, indeed. But as Tim Lindsay very, very aptly put out, I think it's very clear who the winner is. What we're going to be busy reporting is in the next few weeks when the uncertainty over this quote-unquote disputed victory will take place. I think in the intervening time, there will be all kinds of, Tim Lindsay mentioned dark campaigning. I think it will be a continuation of that until the official results come out. We will have a lot to write about, yes.
When you look out your window, Yuli, are you seeing dancing in the streets?
There have been dancing in the streets by the Jokowi camp. Yes, they have been celebrating. The other side has been quite muted, actually. Not very much of celebrating. In fact, they're looking rather glum. So the celebration has been quite one-sided.
Now, let's look briefly, Yuli, if we could, at this mammoth election campaign. 187 million registered Indonesians voted. I mean, the logistics of this are awe-inspiring.
It's not the first time that we've had this, such elections. This is the third. So with all its faults, the Election Commission has done it before, and we still have many faults, but we are able to do it.
Well, it's greatly credited, and it's also, it comes as a surprise, at least to me, to learn that 9 out of 10 voters, 9 out of 10 have a mobile, 1 in 3 have a smartphone. You are a very technically savvy nation.
The social media has played a very big role in the elections, negatively and positively. And that, I think that has changed the nature of the elections, this year's election as compared to the first two. And of course, as you know, a great percentage of the voters this time around has been the first-time voters because of the age, the 17 years. This is the first time that they will be voting in the past 5 years, since the last election.
Elizabeth, you were at the initial campaign rallies where voters told you about handouts, prizes, inducements, and I found this amusing, how they rated contestants by the quality of the food. Please explain.
Well, you turn up to a rally of this contestant and he gives you a jilbab if you're a woman, a hijab in his colours, transport, obviously, and some kind of a lunch. So it'll be either a chicken rice box or it'll be a nasi bungkus, a wrapped up rice and some kind of dishes with it. And people are very funny about which campaigns they go to all of the campaigns, obviously, and they wear the campaign colours because they get the free T-shirts, they get the free jilbabs. They often get cash payments also just for turning up. And the funniest thing actually is the local transport drivers, the guys who have minibuses, for example, and even rickshaws. They get paid, number one, for putting banners on their BMOs, their minibuses, number two, for bringing in passengers, and then they get paid again for parking in an inconvenient spot and causing a traffic jam because the contestants want to look as though they've got a massive, massive rally going. So the guys are like, I just love it. I get to sit around and smoke all afternoon, you know, and I get paid
$25. Well, Elizabeth, I must say it makes our election proceedings sound rather tepid. And, of course, our vote is compulsory. You have to vote in Australia or you get fined. You spoke to thousands of ordinary potential voters who admired Prabowo for being firm, and they muttered approvingly about his iron fist. And yet we now learned it wasn't sufficiently ironish. What do they have to say about Jokowi?
I think that what's interesting about their attitude to Prabowo is, yes, we want an iron fist, and that's the first reaction that you get from people. But actually, if you hang around and, you know, sleep on their floor for a couple of days and cook in their kitchen with them, people say, you know, we need an organized leader. We need a well-organized orang yang tegas, a person who is firm. But we really don't want to go back to being told what to do all the time. We really don't want to go back to a central government that is completely lacking in transparency to us, where there's no accountability. And this is much more the case outside of Java. So, of course, Indonesia is a rather unbalanced nation to the extent that 60% of the population live in 7% of the land mass, just the one island of Java. And in the other areas of Indonesia, this reform period has seen a huge decentralization, which has allowed for the rise of local politicians who are not part of the national machinery. And in fact, Jokowi is one of those. He came up as a mayor of his own hometown and then got onto the national stage by running for governor of Jakarta. So people outside of Java have a great deal to lose by going back to a Suharto-style centralized government, which is what that iron fist of Prabowo's promised.
Tim, quite a lot of the pundits, both in Jakarta and indeed in Australia, will be eating their hats because we were led to believe that, you know, that David could not defeat Goliath, given Goliath's marvellous control of the instruments of power and the money to run a very sophisticated campaign.
Well, I'm not really sure who is David or Goliath in this one, because Jokowi started off as the clear favourite with a lead more than 10. At one point, I think it was closer to 20 over Prabowo, and it was really his to lose. And what Prabowo did was, and his campaign, which involved imported US spin doctors who've been working for years with vast amounts of money and some pretty canny image management, what they managed to do was reinvent a cashiered general who had admitted to abducting and torturing students and is implicated in massacres in East Timor and Papua, to reinvent him as a viable candidate, and using social media and saturation advertising to the point that you would find money occasionally with his name stamped on it, they reversed it. So they closed that lead and brought it down to just 5 points in the end. So what Jokowi was up against was a massive exercise, highly organised, Republican-style
So what are the top three policies, and I use three as an arbitrary figure, that the people of Indonesia want from a new president, Tim?
Well, this has been largely a policy vacuum. This boiled down to a personality competition, but behind it was a bigger question, which I think was just explained by Elizabeth, which is, in a sense, voters were really making a decision about where Indonesia goes after 15 years of democratization and 10 years of what turned out to be fairly lackluster leadership by President Yudhoyono. And the big question was, do we keep muddling on, trying to fix up the model we've got, or do we make a radical decision to go for some extreme solution involving what would ultimately work out to be a reversion back to Suharto with his former son-in-law in the palace? And he even started wheeling out his former wife, Suharto's daughter, and rumours started to spread that he'd remarry her if he got back into the palace. So the choice they were making was really not about about policies. It was about personalities and linked to those personalities where Indonesia goes. And it looks like, by a very narrow margin, they've chosen muddling through.
You mentioned the parallels with the US Republicans' method of campaigning. Is there a hint of the Obama in the winner?
Oh, yes, he's often been compared to Obama, and it's extraordinary that there is really quite a facial resemblance. One difference is that he really lacks the charisma and rhetorical presence that Obama has on the podium. Jokowi's a very good grassroots campaigner with his blusukan drop-ins, where he appears in food stalls or in offices and talks to people. But on the stage, he was generally outperformed by Prabowo, who's a real showman. But like Obama, he's had to face his own equivalent of the birthers. Prabowo's black campaign included allegations that Jokowi was secretly ethnically Chinese, that he was a covert Christian, and so forth.
But this is straight from
even
the
was born overseas.
This is straight from the Republican playbook. This is fully imported.
And indeed, the two American spin doctors that were bought out were associated with the Republican campaign.
Yeah. How about that? Now, Yuli, before we discuss the challenges ahead for your new president, what, if anything, will be SBY's greatest legacy? We've heard Tim saying that it wasn't a particularly distinguished administration, but did it achieve much at all?
I think that the campaign, both on this part of Jokowi and Prabowo, is actually an attack, or they want something different from what they've been having in the last 8 years. So basically, they want something different from the complacency, from the non-action from SBY.
Yuli, I completely accept and understand that, but did SBY notch some achievements up?
You know, it's very difficult for me to bring up any, because the important ones, like withdrawing the subsidy, the fuel subsidy, he never did. And he did not stand up to pluralism when the minorities were attacked, whether they were Christians, whether they were Muslims. I will say this, that he did introduce Indonesia to the world globally by joining in the different initiatives such as the Open Government Partnership, the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, which put Indonesia on the map towards openness and transparency. But other than that, I'm sorry, but I voted for SBY, but in the end, it turned out to be a big disappointment.
Now, Elizabeth, we're looking ahead at a complex policy-making process, and for his part, the new boss has identified religious intolerance and ethnic differences as serious social issues in Indonesia and is calling for a mental revolution. What is a mental revolution?
Campaign rhetoric is what that is. But I think that one of the things that's interesting to me about what Tim was saying, the Republican spin doctors, drawing that parallel with the Republicans, is that they did exactly what the Republicans also always do, which is consistently underestimate the sophistication of the electorate. The Indonesian electorate is incredibly sophisticated. They understand the issues very well. And the mental revolution that's called for is get down to work, let's make our bureaucracy function. Indonesia is not lacking in good plans and it's not lacking in good laws. What it's lacking in is implementation of any of those plans and laws. And I think that one of the reasons that Jokowi played well with the electorate is that they do have some confidence that he has, albeit on quite a small scale in his hometown of Solo and then just for a couple of years in Jakarta, he has shown that he actually can begin to make the bureaucracy work, that he can begin to crack down on petty bribery within the bureaucracy, that he can make people come to work on time and do their jobs when they're there. And just doing that would make a huge difference to people's daily lives in Indonesia.
I'm looking forward to hearing you in Sydney next month, when you be at the Opera House talking to the topic Corruption Makes the World Go Round. And you point out that in some parts of Indonesia, corruption in effect serves as the glue that keeps an otherwise fractious country together.
I tend, when I talk about the glue, to use the word patronage rather than corruption. And again, I come back to the
sophistication of... Who's your spin doctor, Elizabeth?
Well, no, I think there is an important difference. And I come back to the sophistication of the Indonesian electorate. If one of their local leaders, their bupati, the district leader, or their mayor, is outright stealing, if he is taking money from the local budget and flying to Singapore and spending that money on drugs and hookers, which happens, they throw him out of power. That happens. If, on the other hand, what he's doing is taking the local budget and doling it out to slightly inefficient contractors who are building local roads because they supported his campaigns, well, people say, well, we didn't have any road here before, and now we've got a bad road because it was made by a local contractor, but that's part of the process.
And, so of course, it's a part of the process in the United States of America as well, isn't it?
Probably in every country.
Yes, it's sometimes more cleverly camouflaged.
And also, in some places, it's just legalized. And what's interesting is that Indonesia, since the reforms and the new constitution, has really quite strong laws against this. Again, none of them are ever enforced. But in the US, they do the same thing, don't even call it corruption.
I've got to ask you this before I go back to Tim. I think you're very much enjoying what's happening at the moment. You think it's... you're happy, aren't you?
I think it's great. I tell you, I'm a great follower of the Australian National University's blog, New Mandala, which is one of the best sources of scholarship on Asia. And they asked me to do a blog post. I was like, oh, I don't know anything, all these smart academics. And I wrote a post saying Indonesians are not idiots, saying, you know, really, I think that common sense will out in this election. This was just about a week ago. And I got this barrage from people I respect very much saying, you're out of touch and this and that. And so I have to say, I'm having quite a happy I told you so moment, because it would have been, it was a real possibility that Prabowo would get elected. And then you'd have to come to the conclusion that Indonesia would have got the government it deserved. And that would have been a very sad outcome.
Back to you, Tim. When we last spoke in February, as I recall, we looked at how Jokowi could be just the ticket for the job because he'd done such a fine job as governor of Jakarta. Talk to that briefly.
Well, he has a reputation for careful policy formation, for paying attention to detail. He's been pretty successful on welfare-oriented work such as housing, identity cards, health cards that give access to health services and education and so forth. So in terms of hands-on policies that really directly assist the poor, he has a really, in the Indonesian context, a pretty spectacular track record. Now, the issue is that was in a small town in central Java and then in the capital. Can he expand that out across the nation in a quite different role? And can he do it in what is actually, contrary to popular perception, a fairly weak office? Because, in fact, the strongest body constitutionally and politically in Indonesia is the legislature. And the president can command, but the legislature implements. And his coalition will command around about 40% of the legislature. So whether he can get his program through a legislature that he not only has a plurality, but a legislature which will have a very large portion led or associated with Prabowo that will be setting out to undermine his agenda, at least early on.
Might we see another echo of the United States with a very powerful opposition that simply says no constantly, as they do to Obama?
I think that will be a problem early on, but you have to remember that one of the big differences between Indonesia and America, and of course Australia for that matter, is that coalitions in Indonesia are written on water. Then every vote in the legislature is a sort of conscience vote, or rather an unconscionable vote, because it's very common for people to cross the floor to vote against their own party. And my expectation is that after a while, he will start building more workable pseudo or informal coalitions that will let him govern. But I think, you know, he was only supported by a narrow majority, and he will have to demonstrate that he can do better than Yudhoyono has to satisfy the concerns that Yuli expressed. And if he doesn't manage to do that in the first 12 months, I think he will be, in fact, maybe even less than it, maybe the first 6 months, then I think he will really face instability. He's really going to be under a lot of pressure to show that he deserves the office, given how close it's been.
You were somewhat cross with me earlier when I talked David and Goliath, but a lot of the conservative commentary in Australia has come from people who didn't want this outcome, and who do see him as a rank amateur compared to the glossy professional. So, you know, this is still in some ways a culture shock.
Well, I think Australia would have been in for a very rude awakening if tomorrow morning they'd found Prabowo had won. Prabowo is a very volatile and unstable individual. Even during the election campaign, he was involved in scuffles and punch-ups. He has a track record of human rights abuse, of explosive temperamental behaviour.
Of course, yeah.
And all of this would have been extremely difficult. There were already reactions from investors when it looked like he was going to win. So, you know, I think that sort of enthusiasm for Prabowo would have been very misplaced.
Tim, you've been witnessing enthusiasm for a visiting Japanese Prime Minister whose ideological background is, to say the least, unpleasant.
Prabowo-esque.
Yes, it's amazing, really, how flexible Australia can be. I wonder whether there'll be any changes in attitude on the contentious issue of boat people, Tim.
Well, I think that is likely to be a point of tension between Australia and Indonesia, for the same reason that I just gave for the difficulties Jokowi will probably face in the next 6 months, and that is that because it's been a narrow victory, he will be under a great deal of pressure to win legitimacy from you know, half the population. And the campaign was largely run on the basis of nationalist credentials. Both Jokowi and Prabowo asserted that they would respond firmly to any intrusions on Indonesian sovereignty, air or water. Jokowi, unlike Prabowo, said he would negotiate and engage in dialogue first, but he was also quite clear that if that didn't work, he would respond, as he said, firmly. So I think he could not act in the same with the same sort of tolerant and very indulgent response that typified Yudhoyono's attitude towards Australia, despite the wiretaps, and that we're likely to see Operation Sovereign Borders resulting in a few slapdowns for Australia. I don't think that it will be as easy to send back boats and orange lifeboats under Jokowi as it was under Yudhoyono.
Our next story, dear guests, is Sri Lanka, Australia in the boat. So I'm going to stick on this topic, if you don't mind. Elizabeth, have you detected any interest in this issue within Indonesia amongst the punters?
Absolutely not. I mean, except in the islands that are closest to Australia, where anyone who speaks English occasionally gets a gig going and translating for some Afghans who wash up on shore, islands like Sumba, for example. It's really not something that has exercised the Indonesians, to my knowledge, in the way that it exercises the average punter in Australia. It's not really on the radar screen of anyone outside of the Jakarta policy elite, really, to my knowledge.
Yuli, how important will Megawati be backstage?
Well, there's a very warm relationship between Jokowi and Megawati, and he certainly respects him, her. And that has been the question in many of his critics. Is he going to be his own man, or will he be the puppet of Megawati? I think the general opinion is that, as he had said himself in his debate, I can be firm if I want to. And I think that he will be his own man, as he did when he was governor and he was in Solo. However, being the Javanese that he is, he will always I don't think the word is defer, but certainly pay his respect and always consult with her. Now, he is a PDIP person, and he will have to always go back to Megawati. But how powerful her influence will be on him, I don't think we can say right now.
It's an exhilarating moment in Indonesian and indeed regional history, and I thank the three of you very much for your contribution. Yuli, Tim and Elizabeth. Yuli is Deputy Chief Editor of the English edition of Tempo. Tim Lindsay is Director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society at the Uni of Melbourne. Author of many books, including Constitutional Law in Indonesia, published by Hart. And Elizabeth Pisani's latest book is engagingly entitled Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation, published by Granter. Next, as advertised, Australia, Sri Lanka and the votes, and aren't many votes in it. We're joined by three Sri Lankans to get their response to accusations of human rights violations, people smuggling, and the treatment of boat people in Australia. LNL on RNZ.